This Week in Virology, the podcast about viruses, the kind that make you sick. This Week in Virology, episode number 121, recorded February 14th, 2011. Hi, everybody. I'm Vincent Racaniello, and it's time for TWIV, your weekly podcast where we talk all about viruses. And it happens to be Valentine's Day. Happy Valentine's Day, everyone. Today, we have a special episode. We're at the University of Washington in Seattle, Washington, my first trip here. And we have a great crew with us to talk about viruses. Starting here on my left, Dr. Michael Cates, who is a professor in the Department of Microbiology. Welcome to TWIV.
Thanks, Vince.
First time?
First time on TWIV.
Very good.
But I've listened to you.
Very good. Thanks for coming. To Michael's left is Dr. Deborah Fuller from the Washington National Primate Research Center. Welcome.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for coming. Moving down, we have Dr. Sean Iadonato, is that correct? From Kineta Corporation. Welcome.
Thank you.
What's the origin of the last name?
Italian.
Molto bene. Iadonato, right?
Very exactly.
Good. I'm familiar with mispronounced last names. And down there at the end, Dr. Michael Gale, who's a professor in the Department of Immunology here. Welcome back.
Thanks, Vince.
This is Michael's second stint on TWIV. I had him, he visited for a seminar last year. And when he came to talk with me, I said, I'm not going to tell you about my research. I'm going to put a mic on you and record a TWIV. And he was like, what is this? And then afterwards, he realized how cool it was. So today, I want to chat with these individuals about, first I want to talk about how they got to be where they are today, because this is really instructive for our listeners to learn how people get to a career in science, and what are the different pathways by which they get there. Now, Michael, you are my contemporary, right?
Yes.
More or less? You're probably younger than I am.
I'm probably older than you are.
Really? You look younger.
Could be my purple hair.
But I was looking at PubMed this morning, and you published your first paper a year before I did. That was 1978.
Correct.
So where did you start? In Philadelphia?
So how much time do we have?
I'll cut you off when we don't have time.
Okay, so you want to know how I got to here today. Okay, I'll try and give you the short version. So I went to undergraduate at Boston University, majoring in pre-dental. And then I went to the University of Pennsylvania Dental School for 1 year, and then hated it and dropped out of dental school. And then I went to Paris for a couple of years to bum around and to learn French. Then I came back, got a job at the Wistar Institute, studying rabies virus, and then got a job subsequently at the University of Pennsylvania studying herpes simplex virus, working for Gary Cohen, and then I found out that I was working so hard that why don't I go to graduate school? So I went to graduate school at Hahnemann University at that time, working on Coxsackie viruses. From there, I went to the University of Uppsala in Sweden for a postdoc. Then a second postdoc at Sloan Kettering, working for Bob Krug on influenza, and that's when I started working on influenza virus, and worked there for 5 years, and then came to the University of Washington in 1987, and have been here ever since.
You must like it here.
Yeah, I do.
So when were you in New York?
I was in New York from 81 to 86.
All right, I had already left, because I also worked on flu with Peter Pallese.
But right.
From 75 to 79. Yeah.
Right, I forgot that.
Yes. Well, the Pallese and Krug labs were very antagonistic.
They still are.
They probably still are. But
I remember
the first paper I submitted, I know Bob reviewed it.
Oh, God.
Peter taped the reviews outside the lab door. And the first review was good. Wait, did you review it? You're laughing. The first review was good, and the second was, these results are certainly not earth-shattering. Does that sound like a Bob Krug?
That sounds like a nice Bob Krug. I don't think we are allowed to say, is TWIV X-rated or?
No, no, we have a, no. See, we have a clean rating on iTunes, otherwise kids won't be able to download.
Okay, so I won't repeat.
We don't curse. If you curse, I'll have to beep it out. So Deborah, what brought you here to Seattle? What's your pathway?
Oh, yeah. I always tell students when they ask that question that I sort of did everything backwards. I started with a career, and then I went through this period that was sort of a postdoctoral type period, and then I ended up getting my going to graduate school and getting my PhD. So many years ago, I went into graduate school right out undergraduate in environmental toxicology and realized within the first 6 months that I was not excited about smoke plume formations and the like. So I quit and I worked, got a job at a biotech company down the road and worked there for about 10 years. And with a bunch of colleagues there, we discovered a new concept. And it's now, of course, a new type of vaccine that a lot of people are working on, and it's called DNA vaccines, and a new technology to deliver DNA vaccines called the gene gun. And so 10 years down the line, I had my own lab. I was a PI without a PhD. And during that time, of course, with this new technology, we got out and started initiating a lot of collaborations with some of the lead scientists in the field. They were all excited about trying DNA vaccines for whatever infectious disease. Everybody got involved in DNA vaccines. And I was assigned as a person to travel around all over the world, really, and set up these collaborations. And so I call that sort of my postdoctoral period because while I was responsible for showing them how to use the technology, I think I learned more from them than I actually taught them in terms of embedding myself in different labs. And at one point I was collaborating with one investigator at the University of Wisconsin, and he realized, he said, well, I didn't realize you didn't have a PhD, why don't you get a PhD? So
that was terrible advice.
Yes. So the opportunity
came. You should
write
him a letter.
Yes, exactly. I do. We have written letters. So yes, to no avail. Anyway, so I got my PhD in the laboratory of David Watkins. Yeah, we started as a collaboration, and really my experience as a graduate student, because I already was established in the field, was more, we operated more as collaborators rather than as mentor and student. And so my experience is a little different from most students, but it was, I always tell students there is one difference between being a PI without a PhD and being a PI with one. And when I didn't have a PhD, you always had to kind of jump 6 feet over the bar to prove yourself, in the field. And suddenly I had this PhD, my salary didn't change, my roles didn't change, but everybody gave me the benefit of the doubt because I had this piece of paper that said that I could think. So I still encourage students that it's really the right thing to do to go forward and get your PhD. Not necessarily the way I went. You have to be kind of lucky and be in the right place at the right time. But that's how I got to where I am. And of course, my first love and area of research is in HIV vaccines. I'm considering myself a vaccinologist. And I started with HIV simply because I was working in DNA vaccines, which was kind of, at the time in the early 1990s, was a weird idea. And desperate ideas need desperate diseases, and HIV, of course, then as it is now, is still a desperate disease. So that was our first disease we started working on in DNA vaccines. So since branched out into other infectious diseases too.
So you're a relatively new person in Seattle, right?
Yeah, I just relocated from Albany, New York, from Albany Medical College in October. So I am new to the West. I never thought of ever living in the West before. From the Midwest originally, and the East, and I love it here. It's so far, it's great.
So there are many pathways to becoming a scientist, and listeners should understand there's no one fixed pathway. But something popped into my head when you were talking. It has nothing to do with this, but the quote, graduate students forego income so that in the future they can forego income. I thought of that, something like that. Sean, how did you get here? You're a company guy, right?
I am, yeah. Well, it is a tale of woe. I think I did an undergraduate degree in biology at the University of Pennsylvania, and I basically liked working in the laboratory. I wasn't very good at it, but it was sort of like golfing. It didn't detract from my enjoyment. And so, you know, I decided to go to graduate school, and I was in graduate school at Washington University in St. Louis, and the fellow I was working for, Maynard Olson, got recruited here to the UW, and so I ended up coming with him and getting my PhD in genetics here at the UW. And, you know, at that time, I didn't want to do a postdoc. I didn't think I had much compatibility with the academic system in general, and I didn't think anyone would hire me either, probably. So I just started my own company, which is what a lot of people do actually when no one else will hire. And you know, Professor Cates here was actually the chair of our science advisory board, and we had a big program in hepatitis C, and ended up collaborating with Professor Gale and other people here in Seattle, and we sold that company to a public company 2 or 3 years ago, and I guess in a profound error of judgment decided to start another company, this current company, Kineta, where we do a lot of virology work in influenza and hepatitis C. So
right from your PhD to Kineta, basically?
To our previous company called Illumigen.
Previous company, yeah. Very good. And you're the chief scientific officer at Kineta. Now we'll talk more about what you do there in a moment, but let's find out how Michael Gale got to be where he is. You guys worked together at some point? Is that?
I don't have any memory of that.
Professor Cates was my postdoctoral mentor, but my interest in science is long-lived. It kind of goes back to 1969 with Mr. Spock, but anyway.
Were you even born in 1969?
Yeah, I was around when Kennedy got assassinated.
Wow. So was I. I was like 30 when he got assassinated.
I was 2 years old. But the point is, I was born and raised in Western Washington State, and I'm telling this story because I want students to know there's no rule that says you have to have a pedigree where you've moved all around the country to be successful. And I was told that as a young guy, and it almost closed the door on me theoretically. So I attended the University of Washington. I got a bachelor's degree in zoology. University of Washington is a great place for biomedical science, and I was basically immersed in it. I took my first job as a research tech at the University of Washington. Eventually worked with the group that developed the first non-human primate model to HIV infection using the SIV that we isolated ourselves as a group. And that I had such a good time, I worked for 5 years. And then I went to graduate school. So I was a bit older than most students, got my PhD, and at that time, the interferon field was really taking off mechanistically. The Taniguchi lab had identified interferon regulatory factors, extremely exciting. The Darnell lab had identified STATs, so we had the JAK-STAT pathway. And about that same time, protein tyrosine kinases were discovered. So I'm real into mechanistic stuff. And then Professor Cates here at the University of Washington was engaged in research studying a protein kinase called PKR and virus infection and interferon. So he had the whole package. And I went to him, I said, I want to do a postdoc in your lab. This is still at the University of Washington. And some of my advisors were going, no, you've got to go off to Harvard or MIT. And the other thing I didn't tell you is as a young guy, I had a baby. I didn't have the baby, but I helped create it. So I was, you know, 20 years old. I was a junior in college with a little baby boy, and I still managed to do everything I'm telling you, okay? So I went to Professor Cates. He said, no, I don't want to hire you. And then I went back again and again, kind of begging him, and he finally hired me. And I got some terrific training in the area of viral innate immunity. And I'd like to give Professor Cates and his generation actually credit for developing this field that we call innate immunity today. But back then it was all interferon biology. And then, so that was a that was undergraduate, graduate school, research tech, all at the University of Washington. And then the success that I enjoyed as a postdoc propelled me to my first faculty position at the University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center, which was a terrific position because it was a an endowed assistant professorship, which is almost unheard of. So the key to getting off to a terrific start is a strong startup package as a young investigator, and that's what they gave me there. So we were pretty successful. We were there for about 9 years, and then it wasn't in my grand scheme, but when I decided to leave Texas, I was recruited back to the University of Washington. So here I am back here. And the moral of the story is University of Washington over and over again did not hurt my career one bit. So I think the unspoken rule that you have to get, train here and then move, train here and then move, train here and then move is a bunch of BS. And it's all what you make of it.
Well, I think rules are meant to be broken, right?
Yeah.
You know, we had a rule at Columbia that we would never hire a former student as a faculty position, which is an absurd
I think that's
rule.
Bad news because you miss out on a lot of talent.
Absolutely. And we missed a lot of good people as a result.
Yeah.
But you have to be flexible. And of all fields, science should be the most flexible. Well, I since I'm on this podcast every week, everyone knows my origins. But tomorrow when I give, I'm going to give a seminar tomorrow. Right? That's
yes.
Still on.
Yes, it is.
Still have to do that, right? I'll talk a little bit about my origins because I think we can learn a lot about history in science. But let's talk a little science right now. We have some nice time here ahead of us. I want to start with you, Michael. And I was reading a paper of yours last night. And in fact, I have it up here on my laptop. It's a paper published in MBio, which is the new journal, the new open access journal of ASM. This is a nice trend that all the journals are moving towards, putting up all this information that we work hard to produce for free instead of charging right. to see it. But this is this MBio, and you published a paper, A Systems Biology Approach to Infectious Disease Research. Systems biology is not something we have ever discussed on this podcast, so I would like to chat about it for a bit, and if you could tell us what it is and what we can learn from it. Maybe you don't want to talk about that.
No. I'm fine. I can talk about anything. So what is systems biology? I think that is a sort of a one of those terms that means something different to every individual. And there isn't a clear definition, but the article you're referring to that came out in MBio was the result of a contract announcement that NIH and NIAID, Allergy and Infectious Diseases, put out a request for people who are studying infectious diseases to develop a systems biology program. And as a result of that, there were four contracts awarded, and this perspective that came out in MBio is a joint effort amongst the four groups that that were awarded the contract in just trying to put their views ahead of what systems biology is.
What are those four groups? Yours
so the four groups are the University of Washington, but it's a collaborative effort with several institutions. But basically, the University of Washington here in Seattle, Institute of Systems Biology, which is also here in Seattle, Pacific Northwest National Labs, which is in Eastern Washington, and then the fourth one is a collaboration between MIT and Stanford. Working mainly on TB. The PNNL one is working on Salmonella. We're working on influenza and SARS, and Institute of Systems Biology is focusing mainly on influenza and bacterial co-infections. So what is systems biology? I think that it's a term to describe an iterative cycle of investigation where basically you start with an experimental model, whether that be cell culture or mice or macaques or primary cells. You, in our case, infect them with virus. You acquire or you accumulate all the virology and immunology information. You do high throughput omics analysis, proteomics, genomics, next generation sequencing, metabolomics, whatever you want to do. You then work together with a computational biologist and bioinformaticist to try to make sense of this high throughput data, which is a challenge. You then also collaborate with mathematicians and modelers who can work together with this large data sets to come up with predictions and about what genes or what pathways or what networks are important in the infection process. What genes are important for the virus to take over or to defend against the virus. And then they make predictions, and then they turn that back over to the biologist. And so the biologist then have a opportunity to knock down a gene or to infect a knockout mouse, to do something that will prove or disprove the prediction. And then you go through this iterative cycle, and if the predictions are right, then you're gaining more and more insights into the complexity of virus-host interactions. And that the end goal, after you go through all these iterative cycles, is that you make an important contribution to human health. So it's sort of our version or another version of an approach that integrates a multidisciplinary team of individuals to make important contributions to human health. And I think what's unusual or particularly challenging about systems biology is that the multidisciplinary aspects of it. So you work with mathematicians, you work with clinicians, you work with computer scientists, you work with all kinds of egos and all kinds of cultures. And at the moment, I think we're in our third year of our systems biology contract, and I think starting to make some real progress. And I think the challenge is the communication and rules that and cultures that mathematicians have are different than virologists, are different than computer scientists. So it's been a real challenge, I think, to get this team together. But I think that the future of NIH, or the future of experimental research, I think, is going to be related to these big integrated systems biology or multidisciplinary approaches.
So your project is on influenza virus?
Our project is on influenza and SARS.
All right, so let's take flu. What's the, down the road, what can you see coming out of this for influenza that will help human health, as you say?
Well, I hope that what comes out of it is a better understanding of the disease process. So by using different models, cell culture models, mouse models, by using virus mutants, by using omics technology, to get a comprehensive view of what happens in the host after infection, what happens in different, let's say, subsets of immune cells, what happens in the target organs like the lung, and then to identify host pathways or targets that may be able to be drug targets or therapeutic targets, so targets that are not viral proteins or viral enzymes. And I think Sean Iadonato will address that a little bit more in talking about the Kineta program.
So the idea is that it's not enough to have a really good vaccine. We want to have some other therapeutic approaches as well.
Well, I think it is. It's great if you have a good vaccine. I think that the approaches I'm talking about are very applicable for vaccine research. We've used these technologies to assess what makes a good vaccine, how to make a good vaccine, what pathways are impacted after vaccination and challenge. I think that, there's a lot of potential for a lot of areas.
I'm just wondering, because the public is very leery about, it's becoming increasingly leery about being immunized, and I can imagine that would also spread to antiviral approaches as well. So how do we reconcile those two?
Well, I think that the public is leery about just about everything. I think the best way to proceed is to try to educate the public such that they're not afraid. I mean, the autism and vaccination scare was horrible, and it was just recently proven, as scientists suspected, that there was no link between autism and vaccination. So I think that one has to be educated, but unless you're allergic to eggs, you'd be a fool not to be vaccinated against influenza.
So this approach, the systems biology approach, requires very big groups. And so is that the way all science should go in the future? Or is there still a place for traditional small laboratories looking at very specific problems?
Well, I think that, of course, there always has to be a place for hypothesis-driven science, for, you know, for normal-sized laboratories to make contributions. I think that the real determining factor is going to be basically the NIH budget and, you know, what the priorities are of NIH. And at the moment, the priorities of NIH are really moving more towards these large multidisciplinary projects. They're moving towards these large, there's a new center that's going to be formed, a new institute based on translational research. So the direction of the NIH is very, very important for the direction of science.
It just reminds me in some ways of the, you know, in science we've gone through cycles of wanting to do big man on the moon type projects, and then we go back to letting investigators follow their senses. The war on cancer, you remember, pour lots of money into this, but it didn't work. Are we going to come full cycle again in 10 years and realize that this may not be a good way to spend money?
Well, I think that it's going to work. It has already worked to a large degree in the cancer field. I think whether it's going to work well in 5 years or 10 years or 50 years, I think will very much depend on, let's say, the next generation of scientists who go into these areas. And, you know, hopefully more computational biologists, more mathematicians, more non-traditional biologists, I think will be necessary to make a contribution. So I think that I rarely give a seminar without somebody coming up to me afterwards and saying, "You haven't done anything with all your money." I could do more with a toothpick and a auger plate than you've done with billions of dollars. And so, you know, so I think that, it's expensive. It's not expensive as some things, but it is expensive. And I think that we're moving in the right direction. It's just that, it's, I think, rather early in the game to be expecting a lot from these omics approaches and modeling approaches, given that it's really been only in the last decade or so that these approaches have been started.
So on my schedule for the next 2 days, I'm meeting with a multitude of your groups, the proteomics groups, the bioinformatics groups. So you have to do this, you need big labs.
Yes.
So that brings up the question, can all those individuals who are part of the big program go out on their own and have careers, or will they have to be part of other big efforts as well?
That's a problem. I think I think that one of the motivations for people to stay in my lab is because I think they all basically want to get the hell out, but I think what one of the motivations is that it would be hard to sort of reproduce what the lab has to offer. So that actually leads to a much more complicated discussion about the future of training young scientists, of appointing and promoting young scientists, what the criteria are going to be for promotion. And I think that, you know, the world is changing, but the academic infrastructure and the academic appointments and promotions committees and all those things haven't changed. So I think that, obviously people have left the group and have been quite successful. I think that I think the people in my lab would have to go to large medical centers, but could easily, I think, you know, get a faculty appointment in, you know, micro or computer sciences or something like that. So I think they could get jobs. I think that, it's not easy and it's not cheap, but people who have left the lab have done pretty well.
Yeah, I think it's important to remember that wherever you are and whatever size group, you have to remember that if you want to be independent, you have to think about what you can contribute. You have to think, what can I do on my own that will take a piece of this or the training that I have and go forward? I agree with you that we still don't know the results of these projects. That's why we're trying them. And in science, we can try things. That's great. But I don't want to exclude other things. And I still like have people having small labs and following their intuition, doing plaque assays. And remember, a lot of the developments in science came from people stumbling on things, restriction and modification in bacteria, an obscure area that no one cared about except for a few, and led to restriction enzymes. So the problem is that when science gets tied up with politics, then it gets very complicated, and politicians don't always understand. And my pick of the week later is a book which explores this ebbing and rising of support for big and small science in the cancer field. And it's very instructive to see that, how it has gone up and down. Right now, we just came out of an era when the previous NIH head was very translationally focused, and now we're sort of backing off that a little bit. But I think flexibility is very important. Any questions for Michael Cates before we move on? Did you know he's got dollar signs on his sock?
Just for the TV audience.
Yeah, this is
really I got snowflakes on mine. In red to go for Valentine's Day.
Yeah, and the rest of us just have black and gray.
In honor of my Midwest roots, of course.
To get some polio socks. So, Deborah, you are at the Washington National Primate Research Center. Is that far away from here physically?
No, actually, it's right on campus, and there are satellite buildings outside of the campus as well.
So it's affiliated with the University of Washington.
Yeah, obviously. So closely affiliated with the University
of Washington. So sort of like the model of the Primate Center in Massachusetts, Ron DeRosier's.
That's right.
Which is affiliated with Harvard, right?
That's right, yeah. Mm-hmm,
yep. And so, judging from the name, I guess you have primates, non-human primates there.
Yes.
Is that what your research is focused on?
Yeah, a lot of my research has focused in non-human primates. I do work with mice as well, because you like to study a lot of the basic mechanisms of immunology really can't be as well studied in the monkey. But one of the things you learn, and that I always say in a lot of my seminars, is that the mice are dirty, stinking liars. And the truth is, a lot of the experiments and discoveries you have in mice, when you actually go to try to translate those into humans, really 90% of them really don't translate very well in terms of, say, vaccines or therapies. And so while we can learn a lot of the initial basic things that drives us into what we're going to study in the mouse, we have to be cautious as to what, some of the rules that you learn in the mice really a lot of times don't translate.
Interesting you should say that. Someone on a TWIV not too long ago, in fact, it was our episode title, Mice Lie and Monkeys Exaggerate.
Yeah, that is the thing, yeah.
So monkeys, on the other hand, may tell you too much.
Yeah, but they tell you a little bit more. A lot of applications that have worked well in the non-human primate end up translating much better to human clinical trials.
So what disease are you focused on?
So I'm actually focused on an HIV, which, of course, a non-human primate model is really the only model. I mean, they are developing some mouse models, but it's really the only model for HIV infection in human. Monkeys get infected with simian immunodeficiency virus, and they exhibit the same sort of pathology, immune responses, and progression to AIDS that humans do. So it is the preferred model to study and develop new vaccines and therapies for HIV. And a lot of what we have today in terms of treating HIV in humans was initially developed in the non-human primate model. So the majority of my research has been on that. So I got actually very interested in Michael Cates' systems biology approach in terms of actually, how we can apply that in some of the non-human primate studies. I actually got exposed to it many years ago when I was actually reviewing some grants on this new systems biology concept. And there was a lot of debate at the time. And we were sitting around the study section because it's not hypothesis driven. And of course, you're taught as a graduate student that you do hypothesis driven research. And there was just, what is going to be the result of this? And I had, fortuitously, I had actually read, I think it was a Scientific American article or something in, it was some sort of Wired or some other magazine where they'd been doing systems approaches, say in physics and meteorology for years. And they exhibited on this article the things they had discovered as a result of just doing this global look, let's see what's out there, and all the things they had discovered and advances they had made. So, I came into this session with this sort of mentality that, the idea of actually applying such a concept to biology, I mean, there could be all kinds of discoveries. So, and one of the things, particularly in vaccines, and Sean and I were talking about this in terms of HIV, because he was like, well, okay, if we're going to develop a new HIV vaccine, he says, what does the perfect HIV vaccine have to do? And the truth is, nobody knows. We don't know what kinds of immune responses are going to be required for an effective vaccine against HIV. And so a lot of us has, you know, classic vaccinology, you just make a vaccine, you shake it, you bake it, you inject it into, you know, an animal, and then it works. And then we spend the next 80 years figuring out why it worked. Well, with HIV, that hasn't turned out. A lot of the classic vaccine strategies that kill the live attenuated, they don't work. And so we've actually entered into a new era of HIV vaccine research where we're now going to study more closely what kinds of immune responses are associated with say, people who naturally control HIV infection. And you see this in monkeys as well. So the
elite controllers, there are also elite monkey controllers?
Elite monkey controllers that will become infected with the virus and actually never develop AIDS.
And is that associated mm-hmm. with specific HLA mm-hmm. types, as with people?
Sometimes, but sometimes not.
It wouldn't be HLA,
not.
Right?
Yeah.
So, what's it called in monkeys?
Yeah, it's called HLA.
MHC
class 1 molecules and the like. So, one of the things that we don't know is really what kinds of immune responses or what are the factors that, you know, result in control of HIV. And
so is it fair to say that knowing that certain HLA types have a favorable outcome, mm-hmm. can you somehow use that in vaccine design? Is that what you're interested in?
Yeah. Sometimes it's not all HLA, though. I mean, some other sorts of elite controllers may not necessarily be a specific HLA. But one of the reasons why certain people with, say, HLA B27, for example, or long-term controllers of HIV is because they're able to develop a specific type of T cell response that is more effective in controlling HIV. And so then we want to go back to vaccines and say, well, how can we actually elicit that type of a T cell response, you know, through vaccine mechanisms? One of the potential applications with a systems approach is to actually really kind of even take that a step back and begin to ask, you know, what kinds of initial events, innate responses, for example, or gene expression patterns could there be that would actually result in inducing the right type of response for protection against HIV. And that's just an unexplored area right now. It's been very difficult to study from conventional methods of immunology. But with more of a global approach, we can now, like, say, take a group of people that are controlling HIV and a group of people who failed to control HIV and study their differences and patterns. And
it sounds like a question mm-hmm. that is addressable by systems biology
exactly.
approaches,
mm-hmm.
but it is hypothesis-driven. You
to
want
some
to know
extent, yeah.
what do you need early yeah. on to make a good T cell or antibody response,
right? Exactly.
And so you look at everything that mm-hmm. happens in an
yeah.
infected animal,
right.
or even in infected people. I guess you could get specimens and mm-hmm. apply them. So are you doing that? Are you collaborating?
Well, that's what we've been actually talking about, forming a collaboration and studying this, particularly in the non-human primate model, which mm-hmm. is, you know, much more relevant to HIV.
So everyone here is involved in this?
To some extent, yes.
I guess that's why you're all here.
Yeah,
right?
So.
And this podcast.
One big happy family.
And one of the things, of course, I was very interested in Sean's work is the development of possibly new adjuvants. You know, we have all these different types of vaccine strategies, and he went back and looked at the HIV literature, and he says, how come everybody's doing the same thing, you know, in terms of developing new vaccines? And that's because we only have a handful of specific vaccine strategies, and probably the new era is really going to require new adjuvants, and that's a compound that you would co-deliver with a vaccine to try to modulate the type of response that a vaccine is going to induce. So on the one hand, we're going to study what kinds of responses are controlling HIV, and we learn about those, then can we design new adjuvants, and this is Sean's area, that are able to actually direct the immune response, direct a vaccine to generate that type of response.
Public's very afraid of adjuvants, you know.
That's right.
We don't typically use them here in the U.S. Is there a vaccine here in the U.S. that has an adjuvant?
Anybody? Yeah, well, alum has been used quite
HPV
a bit.
HPV vaccines?
Yep, HPV and also monophospholipid A, MPL. Those are the only two licensed vaccines for both the human papilloma virus
HPV
vaccine.
And HBV.
And
okay.
HBV. So, and one of the things, of course, they do is, like, with killed vaccines and live attenuated, they come packaged with their own adjuvants, you know, because
yeah,
they're
sure.
really... And so when you make these recombinant protein vaccines, such as HPV and HBV, you took out the adjuvants, and now we're going to try to more intelligently put in back the specific types of...
I think what the public is worried about is that the way adjuvants are presented or explained is that they make the same amount of immunogen last longer or go longer. Mm-hmm. And the public doesn't like that. In fact, one podcaster called it hamburger helper for vaccines, right? Which is not true, as right. You know. It's different. The goal is totally different, to shape the immune response more like a mm-hmm. natural infection. Exactly. So I think we have to do our job in explaining this, because there is huge opposition to adjuvants here in the U.S. If you look at the forums and the blogs and so mm-hmm. forth, it's very scared.
So
it's a great thing, and I'm sure that future vaccines will be made much better with adjuvants, but we have to explain, otherwise there will be even less compliance with immunization than we already have.
Well, with HIV, I think that's the one that really is going to require the right adjuvant, because with HIV, you have a balance between inducing the right type of response that protects, but avoiding inducing a response that could enhance the infection. So, and I think when we think of adjuvants, not necessarily just increasing the overall response, but modulating it to the right type of response and maybe even towards the right antigens.
Right. So the one HIV vaccine trial that was moderately mm-hmm. successful, the TIE trial, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. was a combination of DNA and vectored glycoprotein, right?
Right, no, yeah, it's actually a combination of a viral vector and a recombinant protein booster immunization.
So part of it was a DNA?
No DNA vaccine.
In that one. But there are some approaches that employ DNA.
Those have are just starting to get into clinical trials.
So what do you have any sense for what one combination or what one approach will work? Will it always be a prime boost strategy, do you think?
Or? Yeah, that's a really exciting new area in terms of combining different vaccines, because we know that with HIV, antibody isn't going to be sufficient. T cell responses aren't going to be sufficient. Usually one type of vaccine would drive towards one response or the other. By combining them, we can actually get a broader type of more both antibody and T-cell response recruited, as well as maybe an appropriate innate response that can direct it to the right quality of the response as well.
So that's one of the questions you're working on, to try mm-hmm. and figure out what combination would mm-hmm. give the best in a monkey model, in a non-human
that's
primate,
mm-hmm.
and then that would have to be tested in clinical trials
in
people,
which
is not a simple thing to do, obviously. These are huge trials. And
exactly.
You have to be in at-risk populations. Mm-hmm. And so forth. I wanted to ask you about another retrovirus, since you do work on retroviruses and since you do work on primates. There is another retrovirus, or perhaps a new human retrovirus, that has garnered a lot of attention. That's XMRV, and its possible role in chronic fatigue syndrome. Have you ever thought about entering that arena, since you do have non-human primates?
Yeah, no, I haven't really thought about entering in that, so...
Take a look at the literature. Mm-hmm. Some individuals have put the virus into non-human primates, I think mm-hmm. at Emory. It's still early days, but a lot of interesting questions with
right.
that one.
Right.
So you had mentioned interaction with Sean. Mm-hmm. So tell us what kineta, what is the word kineta come from?
Moving kineta.
Motion. Kineta?
Well, it was a product of our marketing department at Kineta, so it may not be that we can really determine what it means, but I think that it was a play on, kinetic energy and activity and just the eagerness to do something.
Does that characterize you?
Yeah, I think to some extent I have an eagerness to do something, yes.
How big is Kineta?
We have about 20 people now, which I think is about as big as we want to get. I think being small and helps in your flexibility and the entrepreneurial spirit. And
how many PhDs?
Oh,
or maybe that doesn't matter, right?
That's right. Yeah, that may be inversely related to the level of productivity. Probably six PhDs or so at the company. Yeah, and they tend to span the field of virology, biology, but also math and even engineering. So it's kind of an eclectic bunch of people.
So tell us one of your main projects, if you can.
Oh, sure, I can. Yeah. Well, we have two major thrusts, which are sort of career long thrusts for me. The first is the one that Deb has been talking about, which is looking at natural variation in the human population as it relates to virus infection, and then trying to model your drug development strategy after what you observe. And this was just grew out of work that I did with my thesis advisor on the Human Genome Project, And the idea that medical genetics and genomics and all of that was sort of upside down because it was overly focused on, you know, rare genetic diseases like cystic fibrosis, and it wasn't doing much to actually produce new drugs or enhance patient therapy or anything like that. So the alternative approach, which we have taken over the years, is to sort of have the model that disease is kind of the normal course, and that we should look at people who don't have disease and try to develop drugs that mimic the biochemistry of those people. And often what you find is that you have mutations, people have a disruption in a gene, actually, which it sounds funny to say is essential for disease. And so it's very easily mimicked with normal pharmaceutical development strategies, which are all inhibitor-based strategies. So if you find somebody who eats at McDonald's every day but doesn't get hypercholesterolemia, it's most likely because he has an error in his cholesterol metabolism, and that can be mimicked with a drug. And so we use those models in infectious disease, and we're applying that model to Deb's vaccine development work. So that's part of what we do. And then the other part of what we do is we really focus on the innate immune response, and that's a collaboration with Michael Cates and Michael Gale at the University of Washington, where we develop antiviral products, but they're all focused on the host innate immune response. They're not focused on a specific essential viral protein. So we look to modulate the host innate immune response. What we're really trying to do is develop broadly acting antiviral therapies that work against a number of RNA viruses that are less susceptible to the emergence of drug resistance. So those are sort of the two principal efforts in virology that we have at Kineta.
So you want to use the innate response to try and do something that would have broad consequences. So you can envision one day, I don't know, taking a drug which induces protection against flu, hep C, HIV, all at one time.
That's the idea. What you can see is that we've already identified a number of small molecule drugs. So these would be things that you could take as pills that have broad antiviral activity against flaviviruses and influenza viruses. And then we can actually use Michael Cates's system biology-based approach to really look at what they're doing. And in some cases, they're making very discrete changes to the biology of the system. They may only be modulating 100 or 200 genes as opposed to something like interferon, which is modulating probably 1,000 genes. But in so doing, in having these very discrete effects, they have broad antiviral activities.
So this sounds great for a chronic type viral infection, but maybe for acute infections, it's not a good approach because we can't diagnose them so quickly?
Well, I think you see that in flu. So I think you see that also with direct acting antiviral products, that if you do not administer the drugs within about 48 hours of the diagnosis of flu, you don't get a very effective therapy. And I think in terms of the timing of the way these drugs will work, they're about the same as directly acting antivirals.
Well, with flu, of course, you don't really, most of the time you don't get a diagnosis. You go in a flu season, you have flu-like symptoms, you go to a physician, you get a prescription. You take it within 2 days and it helps. Mm-hmm. And it may not be flu. It may be a rhino or a corona or an adenovirus infection. Now, for flu, you're using Tamiflu, so if you have one of those other infections, it doesn't help you. Mm-hmm. Well, but in your case, yours would help no matter what. So,
well, that's the idea, yeah. So whereas we've had, you know, broad-acting antimicrobials, antibacterials for a long time, we really don't have anything like that in the virus space. And a so-called broad-spectrum antiviral, and I think that's what these compounds are intending to be.
So, what can you tell us something about these compounds? What they do?
Well, they're early days, and they're really a collaboration with Michael Gale and Michael Cates. They're based upon the work that they've done in the innate immune response over many years. Of course, identifying what are the key factors that regulate the innate immune response. And so our antiviral program is really focused on a key transcription factor of innate immunity, IRF3, which is something that this group here, everybody sitting here probably knows a lot about. So the drugs are designed to cause nuclear translocation of IRF3, and they probably do it in a variety of different mechanistic ways because they were really discovered in a hypothesis-independent way. We didn't start with a drug target. We intended to take a very broad snapshot of what might be going on in the pathway.
You didn't have a screen which looked for upregulators of IRF3 activation. That wasn't how these were found?
They were found by looking at promoters that are IRF3 responsive and then confirming that essentially IRF3 is in the nucleus by a kind of automated microscopy-based system. Yeah. We did have some that were actually, that we identified based upon the structure of RIG-I, which is a protein which was made popular, or at least its function was described by Mike Gale, which is a sensor of RNA in the cells. And we were able to construct an in silico model based upon some of Mike's work. And we have identified some antiviral products which we think actually bind to RIG-I, but you know, the compounds don't all function we don't know the drug target for all of them. That's sort of a part of the story, is these RIG-I binding compounds, but I think mechanistically there are others that are doing other things.
I think, Michael, you talked about this when you visited Columbia last year, the strategy of using an agonist, a RIG-I agonist and RIG-I, for our listeners, this cytoplasmic protein that senses RNA virus infections. So you're doing screens for such agonists?
Yeah. Part of the program Sean described includes a directed library screen of compounds that were sort of identified in silico by modeling compound binding to the ligand binding cleft in the specific domain of RIG-I that we think is important for activating the molecule, with the idea that compound interaction would drive a conformation shift that would activate the molecule and hence the pathway. So that we just finished reviewing the hits. The program is going remarkably well, and we have met our milestones for the first part of the program, and now we're moving a set of compounds into the next phase of study for some mechanistic analyses.
So these are compounds that bind to RIG-I?
They would bind RIG-I or perhaps other components in the RIG-I pathway.
So what's the readout that you use to screen for them?
The first readout downstream was a RIG-I or IR3 responsive promoter of a gene that we know gets turned on when RIG-I is active. The second part of the screen was evaluating IRF3 activation, which is the transcription factor downstream of RIG-I. And then the third part was NF-kappa-B activation assessment coupled with cell toxicity and growth control potentially by the compounds. It's pretty exciting. We're at a point where we have a handful of different compounds that have biological activity with the readout we had developed.
So these have been in cell culture so far?
Everything is cell-based. We wanted to make sure we eliminated things early that would have bad effect on a cell. So we went with the cell-based screen.
So if it kills the cell, you put it away, basically.
Yeah.
And then the next phase is to move into an animal.
The next phase is some in vitro mechanistic analyses at evaluating mechanism of action, target pathway, antiviral spectrum, and immune-enhancing spectrum in ex vivo. So does a compound have the ability to drive dendritic cell maturation and antigen presentation? Does it have the ability to induce the immunoproteasome in epithelial cells and thereby enhance an immune response? And then finally, is it or is it not inert against T cells and B cells?
And also, of course, optimization, structural optimization of the molecules to make them more drug-like, make them more potent, so we can optimize the various properties of the drug.
So these would be used, I could see at least two applications. One would be to cure a chronic infection, or could be used with vaccines, perhaps, to modify the quality of the antibody response, right?
Absolutely. We've learned through some studies from my group and Professor Cates, and I think in the field in general, that these innate pathways are very important for programming adaptive immunity. In one study in particular that was conducted by Dr. Mehul Suthar, I think he's in the audience, was the chief scientist on it, but when we knocked out one of the, when we basically knocked out the RIG-I pathway, we saw major defects in the adaptive immune response. For example, the antibody response was defective, the inflammatory response was out of control, T regulatory cells, key governors of the adaptive immune response, failed to expand and control the response. And this goes back to simply knocking out the functionality of the RIG-I pathway. So what it tells you on a systems biology type analysis, the innate response is having huge impact on informing, mitigating, and governing the adaptive immune response. So we think therapeutically we could take advantage of that and regulate the innate response to any outcome based on the readouts we're screening for.
You may remember that the respiratory syncytial vaccine failure was because it didn't stimulate TLR-based innate responses.
Yes.
And consequently, the antibody response wasn't as well developed.
Yeah, so in other words, we find that in the absence of these innate responses, an animal, a mouse, can still make antibodies. They make a lot of antibody, but they completely lose their neutralization capacity. So some aspect of antibody affinity maturation, even isotype selection, and probably boils down to the role of these pathways in B cell development and interactions in the follicle.
But we don't understand how that happens, right? We don't understand how the innate response helps to shape, mechanistically at least, helps to shape the high affinity antibody response.
That's correct. We don't understand. It's a very active area of research today. And my speculation, if you will, is these innate programs are pushing out specific cytokine profiles that impact the maturation of like a B cell, differentiation of a T cell, so on.
Now, you could also imagine that stimulating innate responses in this way could be detrimental.
Absolutely.
So how do we make sure that doesn't happen?
Well, we have this discussion every time we present to a pharmaceutical company, of course, and I have a couple of comments. Well, first of all, with the RIG-I, with these innate immune pathways, as active as they may be, we have evolved to tightly regulate these pathways. So when, for example, the RIG-I pathway gets turned on, all kinds of cell intrinsic controls to govern that pathway also get turned on. So a variety of negative regulators are in place to govern and control immunotoxicity. If we treat a patient with a RIG-I enhancing drug, we expect that these negative control features in the cell will be ramped up and the drug will drive a transient response. And we've modeled that very well in vitro, in vivo, in models, and even through the systems biology approach. So I think the toxicity will be intrinsically limited, and it's also going to be these events have to be very carefully monitored through dosing, designing the best dosing regimen, and so on. Comment is aspirin, I don't think, ever would have been approved today.
If we could not develop any drugs and still get by, we would be very happy
Big Pharma would be happy with a molecule that's as inert as chocolate pudding, which is really not inert.
Well, that's dicey. Chocolate pudding has,
They want us to hand them a compound that has absolutely no toxicity profile at all, which is impossible.
I mean, I think what we can say is that these compounds are going to be an improvement over what we have right now, which is, for example, interferon therapy for hepatitis C infection. You know, interferon has a lot of tolerability issues that are really related to the fact that the cells that are infected with the hepatitis C virus are not really very sensitive to interferon. And the tolerability issues are really related to the fact that you have to administer a very large dose and you excite a lot of cells in the immune system that aren't really infected with the virus. And there are a lot of things that you can do in drug development also to enhance the toxicity and tolerability just by making, for example, a small molecule drug. It can have a transient effect. You can take it every day and it can have a transient effect, whereas interferon is injected every week, so it has a very long half-life. And I would emphasize the other thing is that what Mike has shown is that when you have mice that don't have these pathways, they actually have an enhanced inflammatory response. So it seems as if having a normally functioning innate immune response contributes in some way to controlled inflammation, at least in the setting of virus infection.
Well, also, you have to remember, of course, that these self-limiting pathways in the population could be variable. There could be polymorphisms in certain individuals that make those ineffective. So even though you trial your compound in, 10,000 people, when it goes out there may be one in a million that have a very poor response because of that. But nothing is perfect.
Right. I mean, on the other end of the spectrum, there could be somebody who has an exacerbated response that drives some kind of bad outcome. So, we're aware of those issues, and I think as relevant as those are, they're almost impossible to avoid in drug development. I really don't know how to avoid that issue.
No, it depends on the frequency, of course. If you pick it up in a trial, yes, but typically it's not, and it's only when you move into a big population. Rotavirus vaccine was trialed, the first one was fine, and then when it went into millions of infants, was found to have a problem associated with it. So often you don't know until you move into people, unfortunately. But that's the nature of it.
Yeah.
Anyone have any questions for this august panel before we move on to some email? Now's your chance. You could, yes.
I'm just wondering, I guess when you're looking at drugs that target specific immune pathways, would that be a good idea to look at, the existing populations, if their genetic variation, I guess, kind of what Sean was touching on, and look at, if people have mutations in those genes, such as RIG-I, that actually give them an enhanced response, and kind of if they have any phenotype in terms of controlling viral infection.
Mm-hmm. Well, you definitely...
Can you repeat it?
Oh, yes. I think the question was, is it a worthwhile area to look at, normal human genetic variation and as it relates to drug responsiveness or sensitivity to virus infection and things like that? And that is a very active area of research that... virology is a great place, actually, to look for gene mutations that confer enhanced resistance or susceptibility to virus infection, most particularly to look for resistance to virus infection, because there's an opportunity for selection. So the virus can select for, or has historically selected for, people who have enhanced resistance to certain types of viruses. Michael Gale and I worked on a project at my previous company that was all focused on injection drug users here in Seattle who had injected for more than 10 years and were HCV seronegative. So they were long-term seronegative population of injection drug users in a larger population where most people seroconvert in 6 to 9 months. And we developed a drug based upon that mutation. That's something that was characterized by Michael Cates. So, and that's some of what we're trying to do with our adjuvant development program in the HIV space.
Anything else? All right. I'd like to read a couple of emails, and I picked a few that I thought you guys would enjoy. The first one is from Gopal, who writes, "Hi, Twivers. I am a science journalist based in India and have, over time, become addicted to Twiv. I enjoy the jokes and puns that come along, making Twiv a nice way to broaden my knowledge and keep up to date. I just read an article in The Scientist about Charlie Rice's work. Can we mention Charlie Rice here?
Sure.
Charlie Rice's work with hepatitis C virus. There's a link to this Scientist article. The article says, quote, Vertex's protease inhibitor VX-950, now known as telaprevir, has emerged as a leading agent for the treatment of HCV patients with genotype 1 strain of the disease. A second compound, boceprevir, developed by Shearing Plow, proved equally effective in those patients. So I have two questions, he writes. One, as both drugs in question treat just one genotype, is it the case that there is no conserved region in the protease that can be targeted so that all or most strains of hep C can be treated? I presume that treatment will be a lot cheaper if a single drug can be used against multiple strains than when different drugs are needed for various strains. The latter might also mean no drugs are being developed for strains common in developing countries. Anyone like to tackle that?
Well, go ahead.
Well, I'll just take a crack at it. I mean, I think that the genotype 1 patients have been the hardest to treat historically. With interferon and ribavirin, which has been the standard of care for some time. So I think that's why people have focused on genotype 1 in particular, that Vertex and other companies sharing, you mentioned their drug. But this really does identify, I think, one of the difficulties of traditional antiviral drug development is that you tend to end up with very specialized molecules that only work for one virus or one serotype or one quasi-species, and there is a need for more broadly acting antiviral therapy. I don't know if you...
I'll defer to Mike.
The question is relevant because the genotypes that are of HCV that are present in developing countries are somewhat different. So there are six... There's probably more than six genotypes worldwide. Genotype 1 is prevalent in America and Europe, Japan, developed countries. And then the second challenge there is the initial structure data, I think, on the protease that the drugs were based on came from genotype 1. What we learned from that is the target site of these drugs is the substrate binding cleft of the protease. It's very, very shallow. It's almost non-druggable. And so the challenge was to just find something initially that's going to work and then improve it from there. So the protease inhibitors do have activity against genotypes of non-1, but they were designed against 1 based on structure. As the drugs come out into the clinic, we'll learn more about them, and hopefully that'll drive second and third generations. That'll have broader spectrum.
He also asks, are there other viral proteins that are being looked at in the same way to find inhibitors?
Well, there are. There's a very potent NS5A inhibitor that I imagine one day will get FDA approval. That's a speculation, of course, but it looks pretty good. There are inhibitors of the viral polymerase. So just like the way drug development went for HIV, we have one antiviral now. Eventually it'll be packaged as a cocktail with probably three or more. And interferon is still going to be in the picture, the early days of these.
So these will be used in combination with interferon?
At first.
And then his last point, maybe you could consider taking up hep C as a topic on TWIV and have Dr. Rice join the discussion.
Terrific idea.
It's not a bad idea. Charlie Rice seemed a little reluctant to do this, but I'll be seeing him next month. Maybe we can have a chat. Thanks, Gopal. The next is from Jacob, who writes, I am a molecular biologist working in biometrology. Does anyone know what biometrology is? I don't know. I want to say that as someone who can understand much of the technical details, you guys do a very good job of relaying information to audiences from many different educational backgrounds. Also, as an Australian, it is nice to hear us getting a mention quite often, mostly in regards to our rabbits. Australians and rabbits. Great story. I was just listening to TWIV 112 and wanted to add something to Rich's pick of the week. So on that episode, Rich picked there's a online magazine called The Scientist. They had the top 10 innovations of 2010, and the number one innovation was third generation sequencing, like the PacBio system that you might know about. So he writes, the third generation sequencing technology is certainly amazing, but you guys missed one of the most amazing things about it. Someone mentioned about the background of the other nucleotides floating around, but the thing with this technology is that the reaction vessel is smaller than the wavelength of light. So I think in this technology, the triphosphates are labeled, and only as one goes into the active site of the enzyme do you get a signal, a readout, and that's how the sequencing works. So we were wondering how you dealt with the background. So the sensor is smaller than a wavelength of light. This prevents the background fluorescence from reaching the detector. It works in a similar way to your microwave oven in that the microwaves cannot pass through the hole in the door, but visible light can as its wavelength is smaller. The polymerase is attached to a transparent layer at the bottom of the reaction vessel, so the light from the fluorescently tagged diphosphate is able to pass through this transparent layer and reach the detector. This means that there is essentially no background, so a single DNTP incorporation can be detected. Beautiful. Thank you. On an entirely separate note, Vincent and Dixon have spoken on several occasions about a podcast about physics, similar to TWIV. I only listen to four podcasts regularly, including TWIV, TWIP, and Futures in Biotech, but the fourth is one that I really think you'll enjoy. It's called Astronomy Cast and features two people, one an educated amateur, Fraser Kane, and the other an astronomy researcher, Dr. Pamela Gay, discussing topics related to astronomy, astrophysics, planetary geology, scientific history, and cosmology, and even had a recent episode on exobiology in response to the arsenic incorporating bacteria story. As I write this, they're up to episode 210, each dealing with a particular topic similar to your Virology 101 episodes. I hope you enjoy it. So Jacob is from Australia. Thanks, Jacob. The next one you guys can weigh in on is from Vince, not me, but Vince is in Hawaii. Hello, although phage do not alter our health directly, they do provide novel genetic functions to their unicellular hosts, giving them access to new environments, including the confines of our own bodies. My question is, can phage that are produced within us transform otherwise harmless bacteria into pathogens? Or conversely, can phage produced by our endogenous microbiota infect other related invaders? What do you think? Any ideas?
Well, I think that's clearly a question for Professor.
Aren't there phage that are used by the Russians to treat viral diseases as well? I mean, I think that the concept of using bacteriophage or therapies using bacteriophage are sort of always been out there, but I don't know that the FDA would approve anything related to bacteriophage therapy.
Yeah, there has been a program in Russia for a long time.
And I think that probably the most important part of his comment has to do with the sequencing or the identification of the microbiome. So there are more bacteria in our body than there are cells. And so...
Not in my body, maybe yours.
Definitely more bacteria in my body. And so, you know, with these millions of different bacteria, you know, what is the effect of, you know, of those bacteria on the immune response and the gut-associated lymphoid tissue? So, I mean, that's a huge area, I think, that will shed a lot of light on diseases, like infectious diseases or cancer or other types of metabolic diseases.
Yeah, I'm sure the phages in our microbiota are going to make a big difference in normal and abnormal health. This is a big area. If I were just going into virology, I would think about that because this is uncharted and there are billions and billions of those bacteria there. Isn't which toxin is it? Diphtheria toxin? Isn't that carried on a bacteriophage? Does anyone? I'm wandering into bacteria. No, you don't think so? I don't know. All right, I'll have to look it up. I thought so. If I were doing this, what is it? Diphtheria. If I were doing this in my office, I'd just Google it. Diphtheria toxin is an exotoxin for Karenia bacteria, and where is it encoded?
Wikipedia.
Doesn't have the answer. You know, that was the first hit, but I thought it was carried by, yes, the toxin gene is encoded by a bacteriophage. Yes, so there you go. There is one, of course. Sure. Whether there are others in our guts now, I don't know, but I'll bet there's something going on. It's a really interesting area. And your point that using phages to treat diseases, we actually talked about this a couple of episodes ago. Vincent Fischetti at Rockefeller is actually using the purified lysins from phages to lyse bacteria to try and treat infections. And one of our readers sent us a link to phage usage as a topical antibacterial. So Intralytics is a biotech company in Baltimore that specializes in bacteriophage-based products to control pathogens on surfaces, food cooking surfaces. So instead of spraying Lysol, you spray a bacteriophage. I'm not sure that, but they're a company, and the FDA has approved the use of this on foods. So there you go, can be used. Another one here from another Hep C person. Yes, I picked this for this audience. This is from Patricia, who is a PhD student in virology working on Hep C at the University of Saskatchewan. Nobody says it right the first time. It's like Rackham Yellow. I've been saving up comments for over a year now. Unfortunately, I've always neglected to send them in because I am frequently behind in my listening that I figure someone else will have sent them in. That being said, I was actually reading letters on the TWIV site and realized I can help respond to one of them while actually at my computer. Anna Maria, TWIV 114, asks about a site for people to post examples of things they have tried that have absolutely not worked. I have two links for you. One, the Journal of Negative Results in Biomedicine. We have a link for that. This one, of course, is not for, I did a Western blot with this antibody and there was a lot of background, but more for, no matter what I tried, I could not demonstrate any interaction between this cellular protein and this viral protein. Still very useful for eliminating roads of investigation because others have tried them already. Number two, Scientist Solutions. This site is more immediately useful, as most protocols that people post are then treated as a blog where they write back and forth and folks can ask for clarification. It's a great way to get hints and help from very experienced people to very inexperienced people, and I find that I keep going back to it to look for more protocols. Okay, and one immediate comment. With regards to recent comments from TWIV, the 10 Best Stories of 2010 episode, I just wanted to point out a hazard of using microRNAs when we don't yet know everything or at least enough about them. While the idea of using microRNAs to downregulate or inhibit replication of an adenovirus vector in tissues outside the CNS is in principle quite clever, it could so very easily backfire. Hepatitis C virus relies heavily on the liver-specific and liver-abundant miR-122 to enhance or permit its replication. What if a microRNA enhances the vector in a tissue rather than inhibiting it? We still don't know how microRNAs define whether to inhibit or enhance translation of mRNAs. They do both, although the enhancement findings are less common. The suspicion is that it depends on where the microRNA complementarity site is on the mRNA, but that hasn't been fully defined yet. And she gives a couple of references for this. Thanks so much to all of you for your commitment to this podcast. You have made me smile and laugh to myself while in the hood, which makes me look like a crazy person, or shake my head and frown until someone catches a mistake or re-explains something for me. You've made me, like many others, feel we have a better grasp on the world of virology outside of our own little niche. Above that, I get to share super cool stories with my friends. Sadly, they are less amused by some of the things that I find fascinating. But I keep trying. I hope you never, ever stop sharing with us, Patricia. Okay. Now, here's a flu question. One more now, and we'll wrap it up. This is from Kirsten, who writes, I was wondering if a connection is being considered between the information presented by the Canadian group that correlates enhanced disease following flu vaccination in a percentage of cases. So this was a paper out of Canada where they found that if you had a seasonal flu vaccine, there was a more likelihood of getting more severe pandemic influenza. So it was a small study out of Canada in 2008. So we talked about that. And she said, is there a connection between that and the data presented by Monsalvo et al. That attributes enhanced disease in flu to the presence of non-neutralizing antibodies and immune complexes? So that was a paper where they showed that a lot of the severe pandemic flu was due to having a long prior experience with seasonal flu, and those antibodies didn't neutralize the virus in your lung, but they activated complement. So is there a connection? Could the non-neutralizing antibodies be present due to previous flu vaccination? So yes, that's the whole idea, that you have this long, if you've been infected for many years with an H1N1 strain, which has been circulating for a long time, and then you have a totally new H1N1 strain introduced, those are not well neutralized in the lung, and you have increased pathology. And then she writes, consider the RSV vaccine that was found to contribute to the presence of a low avidity pathogenic antibody. Could there be a similar situation occurring? Anybody know anything about that study here? No? So I think that the Canadian study was a observational study mainly. It could have other confounding factors, so we're not sure about the conclusion. But most certainly the prior experience with seasonal infection is what is causing this enhanced disease, and it is the generation of low avidity antibodies because they don't cross-react with the new strain. But I don't think there's enough evidence to attribute that to immunization. So the Canadian study said if you're immunized with seasonal flu, then you get more severe pandemic flu. But I think the lung pathology study was more a consequence of having repeated natural infections, which give a long-lasting memory response.
You have to remind your viewers that just because something is published doesn't mean it's true. And they should be critical as they read these papers as well.
Yes.
My second comment is that almost every one of these studies is a correlation and epidemiological phenomenology. And so I think it's very hard to come up with conclusions about anything that isn't dissected, let's say, in a experimental model of some kind, where you reproduce what happens in mice or macaques or ferrets or somewhere. So there's a lot of literature out there that is just, not that important.
Yes, we try and, in fact, point out this from time to time. It's true that I don't want our listeners to think that all of science isn't true.
No, my papers are
Your
fine.
Your papers are fine. Everyone's papers here. But, there is, I don't know if you saw in the New Yorker a few weeks ago, there was an article about this problem that basically everything in science is experimental noise. You can't really prove anything. And we're going to actually discuss this on an upcoming episode. And some people feel that epidemiology can never prove anything, in fact. And some people feel that even experimental science can never prove anything. It's a very tenuous road to follow because if people without a good grounding in science hear this discussion, they'll think that what we're doing is all a waste and they shouldn't be immunized or take any drugs whatsoever. So that's not really the question here. The question is that, of course, from time to time, there are studies that are just not as good as others.
Can I make a comment?
Of course.
Yeah. So we were recently, Professor Gale and I were recently at the Pasteur Institute in Paris, and we got a tour, a personal tour of Pasteur's living quarters and of his laboratories and of his crypt where he is buried. So if anybody, I think the museum is open in the afternoons. If anybody's there, I strongly encourage people to do that. But Pasteur himself probably made 8 or 10 discoveries that were worthy of a Nobel Prize. And this is, a person who made a wooden model of the first crystal structure, not knowing what crystal structures were. He discovered, essentially bacteria sterilization, pasteurization. So I think that it's a very humbling experience to visit, go back 100 or 150 years in which there was relatively little money and, very little epidemiology and all that. And yet you have individuals like Pasteur who made phenomenal discoveries with a very low budget.
Sure. No, the history of science is very illuminating.
Yeah.
And in fact, that brings us to my pick of the week. So at TWIV every week, we each of us pick something scientific that we like to recommend. And if you would like to pick the Pasteur Museum, you're welcome to do that.
Yes.
But I will give you, yeah.
I would.
My pick is a wonderful book called The Emperor of All Maladies by Siddhartha Mukherjee. Anybody heard of this book? It is a history of cancer, but it's written by an assistant professor at my institution, Columbia. He's an oncologist, and he's relatively new. But it is a wonderfully written book, starting from the earliest days of cancer, coming all the way to the present, through the surgical phase, the chemotherapeutic phase, and now the specifically targeting phase. And he intersperses it with his experience with cancer patients. It is beautifully written. When I read something this well written, I just stop writing because it is so beautiful. And this guy is taking care of patients every day as well. So I strongly recommend it. The Emperor of All Maladies, really wonderful. That's what I read on the plane out here. I read the whole thing on the way out. And your pick is the Pasteur Museum, which is a wonderful place. Right.
Right.
I've heard it and I've never been. I have to check it out one day. Anyone else would like to recommend something for our listeners?
Well, I have. Actually, it's not technically a scientific book, but it's when I started reading, as I started driving the all-highway route from New York to Washington, Stephen Ambrose's Undaunted Courage about Lewis and Clark's expedition, and I thought I was really going to read about the all-adventure to discover the all-water route to the Northwest. And instead, what I learned was it was a book about scientific discovery. Lewis had to become a crash course in learning zoology, mineralogy, and all kinds of things. And he approached it in a very systems biology way. So while we like to think of Dr. Cates here as a pioneer in systems biology, Meriwether Lewis probably
I think Louis Pasteur was the original
system. There we go. Yeah.
All right. Thank you very much for that. Sean or Michael, anything?
I would recommend The Eighth Day of Creation. It's a wonderful book detailing the beginnings of molecular biology.
Ah. By?
I can't remember the name of the author, but I've read it several times, actually.
Let's look it up. Eighth Day of Creation, Makers of the Revolution in Biology. By Horace Judson.
Exactly, okay. So it describes the early days of the phage group that used to meet every summer at Cold Spring Harbor, how they worked out DNA replication mechanisms and DNA transduction at that time. So that's everything we take advantage of now in the lab.
Great. I have heard of it, never read it. We'll have to put it on the list. All right, that'll do it for another TWIV. Let me just close out here with a few comments. We do have a Facebook fan page, facebook.com/thisweekinvirology, where you can go and check out all the doings around TWIV. We can be found on iTunes at the Zune Marketplace, where you can subscribe and get every episode on your iPod or Zune device. Or if you have an iPhone or an Android device, we have an app that you can use to listen to the episodes. Go over to microbeworld.org. And check that out. You can also go over to twiv.tv, where we have show notes, and you can also download and play the episodes. As usual, send us your questions and comments to twiv@twiv.tv. We also have a new phone line where you can call up and ask a question, 908-312-0760. And no human will answer. You can just leave a recording. Our next TWIV Live will be July 19th in Minneapolis at the American Society for Virology. And then after that, in September in Chicago at ICAC. And I brought along a bunch of bookmarks. If you come down afterwards, you can have one. If you do read books, you can use this to mark your place. Right? And it has where we're going to be and then in some other ASM-related websites. So come down and say hello. I'll give you one of these. If you like TWIV, check out our other podcasts, This Week in Parasitism, TWIP. And next week, we are starting our third podcast, This Week in Microbiology. I'm going to be talking with a bunch of people who work on bacteria and archaea and fungi. So that'll be interesting. TWIM is starting next week. And let me thank everyone for being here. Michael Cates, thank you.
Thanks, Vince.
Thank you for inviting me to come here in the first place. You're my host.
I am indeed.
And so I appreciate the Department of Microbiology here at UW, Deborah Fuller.
Thank you.
Great to have you. Washington National Primate Research Center, Sean Iadonato, Canetta.
Thank you.
So is it a good career to go into for young scientists, biotech?
I really think it is, yeah, I do. Maybe we can talk about that on another episode.
Absolutely, we'd love to. And Michael Gale here at the Department of Immunology. Thank you, Michael. Second
good
time around.
Yeah.
All right, you're an expert. I'm Vincent Racaniello. I'm at virology.ws. I want to thank the audience for coming. I want to thank Scott. Is that Scott up in the back for helping me set up the AV? Rose for helping too. And of course, Angie for arranging all of this. Thanks very much, Angie. You've been listening to This Week in Virology. Thanks for joining us. We'll be back next week. Another TWIV is viral.
Nice.